Daniel chapter 2. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Then the astrologers answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honour. So, tell me the dream and interpret it for me." Once more they replied, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will interpret it." Then the king answered, "I'm certain that you are trying to gain time, because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me." The astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans." This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and the men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. Then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised God of heaven and said, "Praise be the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He disposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what was asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king."
My name's Amy. If we haven't met, I'm one of the youth pastors here. And if you've heard me preach, you know that I like to start with a question. I like questions. So today's question for you is, do you ever think power is in the hands of the wrong person? This could be something simple like you don't think your teachers should have the power to keep you back at lunchtime, right? Maybe it's that you don't think your parents should have the power to tell you when to go to bed. Maybe it's that you don't think Trump should have power over in America. Do you ever think the power is in the hands of the wrong people? That you think, oh, if I had the power, there are a few things that I'd like to change, a few things that I'd like to have control over in my life or in the world. Maybe you're thinking I'd like to be able to choose when I get to go to bed, or I'd like to be able to end world poverty, I'd like to see injustices rectified. Maybe that would be a better way. Well, it's quite interesting because often when we think of the future, we like to think that things are getting better, right? We go, we're progressing, we're getting smarter, more intelligent, more technology. And yet what's quite interesting is that in our movies, in our TV shows, there's actually a big depiction of the world getting worse and worse. Tim Keller, he's an American pastor and author, he suggests that there's actually far more cynicism about our plans for society than there were back in the mid-20th century. He says today nearly all movies and novels are far more pessimistic and they narrate all sorts of dystopian outcomes. If you just think of the TV show Black Mirror, right, it's described as this sci-fi anthology series that explores a twisted, high-tech near future where humanity's greatest innovations and darkest instincts collide. Don't know if you've ever watched the show, but you don't feel good after watching it. You go, ooh, it's a little bit too close to home. You can just see how quickly we could move from where we are into a really dark place. And so are things getting worse? Are we heading to a more twisted future? Is power in the hands of the wrong people? Where is this world heading? For Daniel and his friends, as we look at this passage, we explore their world, where they're at. My suspicion is that they actually had some pretty similar questions. They'd been deported from their land. They'd been brought into this foreign country. They were living in Babylon. And I can imagine them asking under the power of a ruthless king, where is God in all of this? Is he in control or is King Nebuchadnezzar in control? And so tonight's passage, we're going to look at all of chapter 2. It actually answers these questions for us. So let's dive in. Chapter 2, I hope you've got it open because we're going to be looking at a bunch of different places all throughout it. We didn't read it all because there's lots there. But chapter 2, it begins with a problem. Like all good stories, we like to have a problem. Like, oh no, what's going to happen? This problem, King Nebuchadnezzar. If you read with me, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, his mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. Many people today, if you have a bad dream, it keeps you awake, we tend to kind of just brush it off, right? We don't really even talk much about dreams. Maybe over lunchtime or in the morning. If you've ever sat with me at breakfast at Impact or on Mission, it's one of my favourite questions. I like to ask people, what did you dream about? Because I have really quite wacky dreams. And no one can decipher them. They go, how do you even think of that? And I'm like, I don't know. But our dreams are often dismissed. We just go, that was weird. You must have had too many bananas or garlic or you were too hot. Something happened there. Right? Often, we dismiss our dreams. But in this world, in King Nebuchadnezzar's world, it is quite different for him. What he does, if he has a strange dream, it was widely believed that actually this could be a message from the gods. This could be something divine. This could be something actually really important that you need to listen up and pay attention to. And so if you remember from last week, we've got King Nebuchadnezzar. And as he brought people over from Judah, he also brought over some of the temples some of the articles from the temple of God, and then he brought it into the treasure of his God. And so Nebuchadnezzar, he has this whole collection. He's got all these idols, all these gods that he hoped would bless his kingdom, it would bless his rule. And so believing that he's got this plethora of gods to choose from, this plethora of gods that he might hear from, he needed a team of experts, right, to help him to interpret this divine message. Because they believed not everyone could interpret these messages. You needed experts. And so here in chapter 2, when it talks about the different people he had, they're all experts in that particular field. Right? He wanted an expert magician, expert enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers. He wanted the best that Babylon could offer in order to tell him what this dream meant. And so the conversation between Nebuchadnezzar and his experts, it starts off calmly enough. He tells them, okay, guys, I've had a dream. It troubles me. I want to know what it means. Now, my imagination of this scene is that they're standing there and they're kind of just waiting. And it gets a little awkward because they're expecting the king to tell them what the dream is, right? That's their job. You tell us what the dream is, we'll tell you the interpretation. That's how this thing works. But Nebuchadnezzar doesn't tell them the dream. So they kind of, one of the astrologers, they pipe up and they say, oh, look, yes, King Nebuchadnezzar, we would love to interpret this dream for you. If you would just tell us what it is, let's hear it. And I can only imagine their shock at Nebuchadnezzar's unreasonable response. Because he shoots back, you know what, if you don't tell me what my dream is, I'm going to make sure that you are dead and that your houses turn into a pile of rubble. Like, talk about escalation very quickly. Like, maybe it was a really bad night's sleep. He's a bit sleep deprived. But these poor guys over here, they're like, no. That's not how it works. You tell us the dream and then we'll tell you what it is. And he comes back again. Tell me or I'm going to have to kill you. And so they're a bit exasperated. And they're like, okay, look, we're just going to have to spell it out for you. They spell it out at the risk of their own lives. They're like, all right, King Nebuchadnezzar, there is no one on earth. It's almost like we're the experts. If we can't do it, nobody can. There is no one on earth who can do what you're asking. No king, however great and mighty you are, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. This is a key verse in this whole chapter. And I actually quite love it because it really sets up the whole chapter. It actually reminds me of Ocean's 11. Hands up if you've seen the movie. Okay, most people. There's a scene in it when they're going to explain, all right, guys, this is the plan. Right? And you've got George Clooney's character, and you've got Brad Pitt. And George is going through, okay, this is how difficult the plan is. There's these codes that change every few hours. There's fingerprints we need. There's voice recognition. There's a vault that is inconceivable to man. So he sets it up to be difficult. And then you've got Brad Pitt on the side kind of like amping it up a little bit, being like, and we can't get those codes, and we can't get those voices, and we can't get those fingerprints. And so it just amps it up more and more, being like, this is impossible. And the point of that scene, the reason why it is in the narrative, is so that later, spoiler alert, when they actually do it, they've done the impossible and you're there in awe going, this is incredible. They have done something that seemed impossible. And so I wonder if you can see the similarity in Daniel's narrative, that this has been placed in the story to set up the scene that this is no easy task, what the king is asking. I imagine God kind of overhearing that convo where they're saying, look, no one can do it. It's too difficult. And God's just there thinking, oh, really? Who do you think gave Nebuchadnezzar that dream? Who do you think gave Nebuchadnezzar this unreasonable idea to have the dream told to him first, something that was not common practice for his day? Who do you think put that idea in his mind? Often we kind of miss the small markers in our life that tell us that actually God's in control, that God's invisible hand is behind all of this, even in the small details. Notice it in the different way that Nebuchadnezzar actually deals with Daniel compared to all the experts that he had. In verse 8, Nebuchadnezzar accuses these guys, these experts, of trying to gain time. And the pace of the narrative actually would suggest that Nebuchadnezzar is in quite a hurry, right? The dialogue, tell me my dream, we can't. Tell me or I'll kill you, we can't. Tell me, it's too difficult for anyone. You're dead to me. Boom. Execution is ordered. People are sent out to go and kill all the wise men. Nebuchadnezzar is in a rush. There's no time to waste. Things are happening quickly and irrationally. And then you have Daniel come into the scene. He has the audacity in verse 16 to go to the king and ask for more time. The very thing that King Nebuchadnezzar just accused Daniel's colleagues of trying to gain, which led to their execution. Again, I think we overlook these small details because None of the commentaries that I read, even when people are retelling this part of Daniel, people don't focus on verse 17 and how believable, unbelievable it actually is. If you go from verse 16, at this, Daniel went into the king and he asked for more time so that he might interpret the dream for him. And then Daniel returns to his house. Ah, did he now? He just walked right out of there with more time granted to him. How do you think that happened? It must have been the hand of God. Maybe it was through Daniel's words. He spoke with wisdom and tact. But who gave him that wisdom? Who gave him that tact? It was God who was at work there. It was his plan that the experts would fail and that Daniel would get the time he needed to have the mystery revealed to him. And surprise, surprise, as the narrative continues, the mystery is indeed revealed to Daniel. We notice that we have this little psalm here in verses 20 to 23, which is where we finished our reading. We have this psalm, and I wonder if you'd consider if these weren't here, right? If that little psalm wasn't there, because it would actually read like quite smoothly. If you went from 19 and said, during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven. Then Daniel went to Arioch, yada, yada, yada. It could be read like that. And yet the writer of this narrative has said, no, it's important that we put in this psalm. We put in what praises Daniel said after he had heard the dream and after he had heard its interpretation. The narrative pauses so that we get to witness and perhaps even participate in Daniel's praise. This psalm gives us a glimpse into the dream and its interpretation, and it points us to the main point of this passage. Daniel's response in the first verse of verse 20 says, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. There's something about this dream which Daniel's just heard. There's something about that dream that reminds him God is in control. God is to be praised because he is in control. Daniel's here in a foreign country. His execution has been ordered. Things aren't looking good for his people. They're divided. Some are already in exile. Some are not doing so well. And Daniel lets out this sigh of relief. That's right. God is in control, even in these circumstances. This quiet confidence, it stays with Daniel as he then goes and enters into the king's throne room. Because you'd think that as Daniel's going in, he would get straight to the point, right? He already knows it's a bit of a miracle that he's been given more time in the first place. He knows Nebuchadnezzar is in a hurry. People's lives are at stake. Surely Daniel just wants to get in there, tell the king the dream, tell him the interpretation, and then save the day, save everyone's lives. But nope. First, what he does is he goes in there and he sticks up for his colleagues. I want you to notice the links between verses 10 and 11 and then verses 27 to 28. 10 and 11 is when the experts are talking to Nebuchadnezzar and they say, look, there's no one on earth who can do what the king asks. No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans. And then Daniel is there telling the king, you know what? They're right. I back them. No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery that he's asked about. You have asked something, King Nebuchadnezzar, that is too difficult for them to do. But then he goes on and he says, but there is a king in heaven who reveals mysteries. Go, Daniel! In one breath, he has vindicated his colleagues and he has pointed out how superior God is. As Daniel talks, he's ensuring that the king knows it is God who is behind all of this. God has shown King Nebuchadnezzar the dream. God has revealed the mystery of the dream to Daniel for the king. Daniel is essentially saying to the king, look, your dream, it's important. We're going to get to that. Your dream is important, but less important than recognizing the supremacy of God. As Daniel explains the dream, King Nebuchadnezzar learns more about who is actually in charge. God seems to take what's familiar to King Nebuchadnezzar and then speak through that. So, for example, huge statues, which is what's described in the dream. So the dream has this big statue, head of gold, shoulders, arms of silver, belly, legs of bronze, then goes to iron, then the feet is iron and clay. So there's this massive statue. And statues were pretty common in their day. You might have a statue for a god, you might have it for a ruler, but you would put these up to kind of honour those two things. And so maybe Nebuchadnezzar's there wondering, okay, is my dream about the gods? Is my dream about me? But then what about the different metals? What do they mean? Why gold and then silver and then bronze and so on? In their day, there was a poet, and he actually wrote something similar about statues and about different metals. And when he wrote about it, he was signifying different eras. Each era less noble and increasing in violence and misery. So Nebuchadnezzar may have picked up on the theme of eras. But then there's this rock that strikes the statue. What could that possibly mean? As Daniel interprets the dream, he's actually claiming that God, the God of heaven, knows the future, and what's more, he actually controls the future. The statue represented different eras of kingdoms to come. And so beginning with King Nebuchadnezzar, who's the head of gold, and then it moves through to these other kingdoms that are to come. As Daniel moves from the head to shoulders, knees and toes, the value of the metals decrease. But to some extent, it gets stronger until we see these divided kingdoms at the feet. Now, in our biblical text and the interpretation here, it doesn't actually tell us who are those future kings to come, who are those future kingdoms to come. And we can use our other sources, we can use history and can get a pretty good guess. But actually, that's not what's most important here. The only kingdom worth knowing more about is the one that is signified by the rock. Read with me with verses 34 onwards. It says, while you were watching, so this is Daniel telling King Nebuchadnezzar his dream, while you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were all broken to pieces and became like chaff on a threshing floor in the summer. The wind swept them away without leaving a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth. From what we can gather, the rock was a pretty unknown metaphor outside of the Bible. Nebuchadnezzar wouldn't have had any idea what this rock signified. And yet for Daniel and his friends, for a Jewish audience, the supernatural rock that becomes a mountain that fills the whole earth, it would have reminded them of passages from Isaiah, from passages from the Psalms. So for example, Isaiah chapter 2, it says this, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let's go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. Or if you go through the Psalms, there are numerous places throughout there where it talks about how God is the rock. God is our rock. For example, Psalm 18, the Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer. And so when Daniel says these words, it would have made a lot of sense. When he says this, in that time of those kings, the kings represented by the gold and the silver and the bronze and so on, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. I imagine that while being in exile and under some measure of oppression, Daniel and his friends found some comfort, some encouragement in these words. To be told by God, hey, it might look like these kingdoms are strong, like they are mighty, it might look like they're in control, but things are not outside of my plan. and my kingdom will outlast all of them. Since the time of Daniel, God has continued to reveal himself to us. He's given us his word, which we read and we open up and we learn more about him through. But he's also given us his son, Jesus Christ. When Jesus came, he showed us what God is like. And Jesus is the king of that coming kingdom. Jesus is the king of the coming kingdom. Isaiah and 1 Peter, they describe him as the precious cornerstone. Isaiah 28 says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who relies on it will never be stricken with panic." And then in 1 Peter, it quotes that verse and then goes on to say, "Now to you who believe, this stone is precious. But to those who do not believe, the stone the builders have rejected has become the cornerstone and a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall." For Daniel, this is a life lesson that he needed to know at that point, but that he needed to hold on to. At the moment that he hears this dream, he doesn't know what all the future holds, but he is at the beginning of a very long and difficult season. He and his friends have been carried off to work in Babylon, but actually things are about to get worse. The narrator tells us that this is the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign. But then if you go back to the history books, to 2 Kings, it tells us that it was in the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar that he set fire to God's temple, destroyed Jerusalem, and all of Judah was sent into exile. That's 17 years later that things actually seem to be getting worse. Daniel needed to remember this for all of his life. And I think sometimes we come to church and we hear something and we go, "Oh, yes, needed that. Like, that's so relevant to my life. I need to be reminded of that right now." But then we kind of move on and we want a fresh revelation. The next week and then the next week and then the next week. But this revelation that God is in control of your life is always relevant. It is always something that we need to be reminded of. Even this week as I prayed for people, because I've been thinking about it so much, I noticed how in every prayer it would come up, how every prayer I would refer to God's sovereignty about the fact that he is in control and that he has all our circumstances. It is always relevant for our lives. And we'll see throughout the book of Daniel that he returns to this again and again because his hope is in the fact that God's kingdom will endure forever. It is that hope that helps him to stand against the tide. And so we need to remind ourselves that God is in control and that his kingdom will outlast them all. And to be honest, that can be quite hard sometimes. If God is in control, then why didn't he stop that from happening? It's all well and good for Daniel because God stopped King Nebuchadnezzar from killing Daniel and killing all the wise men. But what about when you're being bullied at school and that isn't stopping? What about when someone runs into your car or someone you know is tragically lost in a car accident? Or if you are abused or sexually assaulted, someone close to you gets really sick and there's no cure. Or you unexpectedly lose your job and your world turns upside down. What about all the other situations I haven't mentioned that are represented in this room in which you think, you know what, if I was in control, things would have played out a little bit differently. Well, in those times, how do we find encouragement? How do we find comfort in the fact that God is in control? I believe it is in the hope that God offers. We remember the Psalms that we've just spent 15 weeks studying. Remember the fact that we can pour ourselves out before God and we can turn to him and pray to him. And we trust God, putting our hope in the fact that his coming kingdom is coming, and that will help us persevere until he returns. In the words of one of our latest songs that we're about to sing, it says, "Though I may not see what the future brings, I will watch and wait for the Saviour King. Then my joy complete, standing face to face in the presence of the Ancient of Days. None above him, none before him, all of time in his hands. For his throne shall remain and ever stand. All the power, all the glory. I will trust in his name. For my God, he is the Ancient of Days.